Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio. If you're listening to this broadcast on medium or shortwave in Europe or America, then this announcement is for you. As of July 1st, our programs will no longer be broadcast in these areas and on these frequencies. But they will still be available via satellite, on the internet, on demand and in podcast, and on local radio stations that rebroadcast them. For details, visit our website at vaticanradio.va.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature programme. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, the world-famous Westminster Abbey Choir arrives in Rome to sing for the Pope on the feast of Saints Peter and Paul. And an international group of Anglican priests makes a pilgrimage to Rome in the footsteps of Saint Paul. Hear a Pauline perspective on the journey towards full Christian unity. In September 2010, Pope Benedict attended an evening prayer service in London's Westminster Abbey during his four-day historic state visit to the United Kingdom. In the ancient abbey, the Pope and the Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, prayed at the tomb of the unknown soldier and at the shrine of the 11th century King Edward the Confessor before pronouncing a blessing together at the end of the service. As a direct result of that event, the world-famous Westminster Abbey Choir is here in the Vatican this week to sing alongside the Sistine Chapel Choir at the Papal Mass for the feast of Saints Peter and Paul on Friday morning. In issuing the invitation, Pope Benedict stressed that such an event may serve to encourage the enriching mutual exchange of gifts between the two liturgical and cultural traditions. As Westminster Abbey is formally called the Collegiate Church of St. Peter at Westminster, there will also be an important shared resonance as both choirs celebrate their patron saint together. To find out more about the choir's history and about the programme of events for this visit, I spoke to the Dean of Westminster Abbey, Reverend Dr. John Hall. A little bit about the history of the choir to begin with, if you could, because music and singing have been a vital part of the life of Westminster Abbey for over 1,000 years, haven't they?
Yes, and the monks were here from 960 that we know of. They may have been here earlier, through until the dissolution of the monastery in 1540. Then they were re-established in 1556 and dissolved again in 1559. But the Lady Chapel had a choir of men and boys way back in the 14th century. And so the choir that we have, which was re-established by Queen Elizabeth I in 1560, owes its origin to that Lady Chapel choir that would have sung all the daily offices and at the Mass in the Lady Chapel every day, mirroring the monastic offices being sung in the main church.
And the choir continues to do exactly that, doesn't it? Its main function today is the daily office.
Absolutely right. And they sing 8 services a week, 3 services on a Sunday, Matins and the Eucharist and Evensong. And they sing Evensong every day of the week except Wednesday when it's a said evening prayer. So it's a big demand. And we employ, as lay vicars, the men in the line, professional singers who are contracted to us. And many of them also have other professional singing work, but they're contracted to us. And we educate the boys in our own choir school, which is simply for the education of the boys in the choir. So we have 31 boys just at the moment in the choir, choir school, and 22 normally sing every day in the choir.
Now, the choir has already sung for Pope Benedict during his 2010 visit to Westminster Abbey. So it's not an absolute first, but it's the first time they're coming to the Vatican, isn't it? A very significant event.
It's absolutely the first time they come to the Vatican. The Pope came on the 17th of September 2010, part of his visit to the United Kingdom. And it was a big ecumenical service of evening prayer. And I'm absolutely clear that the Pope was impressed by the music and delighted by the music. In fact, he said to me afterwards that he had some discs of the choir, and he said to our organist that he would like some discs of the choir. So we sent him five discs of the choir, and we'll be very pleased indeed to be singing in the Basilica. It's much more than we could possibly have expected, and it will be completely thrilling.
Now, in St. Peter's there, you'll be singing for the Papal Mass, marking the feast of Saints Peter and Paul, together with the Sistine Chapel. This is another first, isn't it?
I understand that no choir ever in the history of the Sistine Chapel choir has sung with them at a papal service. So it's a tremendous honour, and it's going to be very wonderful, I think. It'll be an extraordinary experience for the boys and for the men, actually, because they won't have experienced that kind of service. And I hope that it'll be a mutual benefit, that in some way there's a mutual exchange. It'll be a great experience for us. But it may also just signal to the sort of wider world the existence of this, of the Anglican English tradition of music. And perhaps it also will help the re-establishment, I hope it might do this, in the sort of public mind of the importance of the great tradition of music that we enjoy and are privileged to have in this place, which is from every Christian tradition, Catholic, Counter-Reformation, as well as Reformation and everything since. And I hope that others might be inspired to think, well, our liturgy can be enlivened by this music too.
Tell us a little bit about the choice of music then. What exactly can we expect to hear?
The Pope was very explicit, I gather, with the Maestro Direttore of the Sistina, that the two choirs should form one choir for the Mass. And I gather that there's to be a setting of a Palestrina Mass, the Missa Pape Marcelli, which the two choirs will sing together. But the Pope also was clear that he wanted to hear some Anglican, some English music around the liturgy. And there will be opportunities, I think, both when the pallia are imposed on the Metropolitan Archbishops, but also at the beginning and end, for some English music, which will be some of it in Latin, some of it in English, but clearly from the Anglican tradition. And I think that is also very exciting.
The two choirs have practiced together once before, haven't they?
The Sistine Chapel Choir visited England in May with the purpose of practicing with the Abbey Choir. And they also, while they were here, sang a concert in Westminster Cathedral, the Roman Catholic Cathedral, here in London. And I gather there was a standing room only fast crowd came to that. And so I think they'll sing well together.
They're singing here, as we said, on the feast of Saints Peter and Paul. It's a particularly significant date, isn't it, as the abbey itself is actually named after Saint Peter.
Yes, and the 29th of June is always a great feast for us. We have, of course, a big sung Eucharist at 5 o'clock, usually our sung Eucharist during the week. And we also have a big banquet afterwards, which has great traditions attached to it, connected with St. Peter and fish. And we would never normally give up that celebration, but we've moved it this year to the 6th of July, to the octave day, as it were, so that we can be in Rome and keep our great feast. There's a wonderful legend, which perhaps dates from the 13th century, that in the 7th century, when an abbey we don't know of actually in any other way, but the legend is clear, the abbey had been built, a church was to be consecrated, and a fisherman was summoned to row someone across the river to Westminster, and the fisherman then heard the sound of singing and saw light in this new church. And afterwards it was discovered that the oil from the consecration was dripping down the walls. And so it was concluded that this was St. Peter himself who'd come and who had consecrated his church. Now, we say the 13th century perhaps was the origin of that, because I think there was a decision in the 13th century that the abbey was responsible not to the Bishop of London, but to the papacy, which is incidentally is why it's a royal peculiar now. When the King Henry VIII took over that responsibility, it became subject to the crown instead of to the Pope. So we think of it as a legend, but a charming legend, and it certainly indicates a very strong connection that the abbey has always had throughout its history with St. Peter.
As well as that key appointment there for the papal mass, the choir will also be singing at a couple of other Roman basilicas here, won't they, and also at the Benedictine Abbey of Monte Cassino.
Yes, there's a concert in Santa Maria Maggiore on the 27th in the evening, when the choir will be singing music by English composers, largely Taverner and Parsons and Purcell and Phillips and Handel and Bird, obviously, and more modern composers such as James Macmillan, a new song by him, and William Walton, a coronation music, and marvellous music by William Harris, which was also sung at the coronation. And then in the Sistine Chapel, there's going to be a private recital for the papal household and for the Vatican on the 28th, then the Mass on the 29th, and then in the evening on the 29th, we're singing Evensong in the Church of Santa Maria Sopra Minerva, which is the titular church of the English Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor, who was Archbishop of Westminster, and he is going to preach at that service. Then we go on to Monte Cassino to develop further the relationship that we have with this great Benedictine church. We're loyal to our Benedictine tradition and consider it to be of very great importance. And so it's a great pleasure for us to continue developing the relationship with Monte Cassino. I lit the torch for the journey to St. Benedict's Shrine in 2011 here in Westminster Abbey, and followed it out then, and the relationship has developed. So we'll be singing Vespers on Saturday evening and the Mass on Sunday before we return to London.
My soul doth magnify the Lord, and my spirit hath rejoiced.
How significant do you think these kind of exchanges can be to further the ecumenical dialogue at the moment?
The Pope, when he was here in 2010 and on other occasions, has spoken in very deliberate terms about the long journey towards full visible unity, that the goal between Roman Catholics and Anglicans is that we should be working together as far as we possibly can towards the goal of full visible unity. Now, we know that there are many obstacles on the road, and the obstacles seem to be increasing sometimes rather than decreasing. Nevertheless, the commitment to working together, to walking together on the road to full visible unity is one that is made very clearly from both sides. If we're to do that, we need to have a greater understanding of each other's tradition. And we need to do that beyond simply the English-speaking world. And it's a wonder to me and a delight to have the opportunity of developing this relationship with Monte Cassino, and now in Rome as well. I see that as a direct fruit of the visit of the Holy Father in September 2010, and as a mark of the importance attached to the journey together from Rome as well as from our side. And not everyone agrees that it's very important. I believe it is very important, and I believe that it will, in God's good time, by his grace, result in full visible unity. In the meantime, there is much communion that we share. We respect each other's baptisms, we see each other as part of the church in the very broadest sense, and we are Christians with respect for each other, and we can learn from each other, and we can give to each other. And in this mutual exchange of gifts, there is the promise of full Eucharistic unity in God's good time, as I said. And I just am immensely grateful that this opportunity has arisen.
My thanks there to the Dean of Westminster Abbey, Reverend Dr. John Hall. A pilgrimage to the tombs of Saints Peter and Paul marks an important moment for many of the visitors who flock to Rome over this summer season from countries around the world, like the official delegation from the Orthodox Patriarchate of Constantinople, which comes to Rome each year for the feast of Saints Peter and Paul. So Christians of all denominations come here to pray at the tombs of these great saints. Church of England biblical scholar Dr. Paula Gooder is a member of ARCIC 3, the Anglican Roman Catholic International Commission, which held its second session in Hong Kong earlier in the spring. She's also a canon theologian at Birmingham and Guildford Cathedrals in the UK and has just been in Rome accompanying an international group of Anglican men and women clergy known as the Society of Catholic Priests. I caught up with her to find out more about this group and about her ecumenical hopes and vision in the wake of the recent ARCIC encounter. Dr. Paula Gooder, you're here in Rome on pilgrimage with this group of Anglican ordained men and women that was welcomed by Pope Benedict at his Wednesday general audience. Tell us a bit about this group you're leading and why this choice of name, the Society of Catholic Priests.
Well, the Society of Catholic Priests was founded in the 1980s within the Church of England. And their great goal at that point, and still remains, was to support men and women in holy orders within the Church of England in terms of ministerial formation and evangelism. So it's a society for support and care of people within the Anglican Church. But the Anglican Church, Church of England, is one which is a very broad church, and there are those who would define themselves much more towards the Protestant end of the spectrum and those who would define themselves much more towards the Catholic end of the spectrum.
So your society would be more towards the Catholic end,
yes, is that correct? Yes, that's right, and the choice of the name is very deliberately to indicate that it is more towards the Catholic end of the spectrum.
So founded in the 1980s and today has the same goals of supporting priests in ministry.
Yes, indeed so. And what is very important about the conference that we're here this week exploring is that it's the very first international conference of the Society of Catholic Priests. They now have provinces in America and in Australia.
Big numbers now belong to this society.
It's much larger than it was, but there are 80-odd people here on the conference. So it's a good spread of people, very interesting.
What is the focus of your conference, your meeting here? Why the choice of Rome for the location?
There are two reasons, I think, for meeting in Rome. One of them is that the members of the society are Catholic in inspiration, and therefore, of course, for anyone who is inspired by Catholicism, Rome is the place to come. The other reason is because we are studying St. Paul this week, and in particular we are looking at Paul's Roman life and experience. And so the work that I've been doing with the society this week is exploring both Paul's life, but also his letter to the Romans. And so we've been reading our way through the letter to the Romans. And then yesterday we had a wonderful day following in the footsteps of Paul in Rome. And we ended up in the Abbey of St. Paul outside the walls and had the most wonderful welcome of hospitality from the Benedictine brothers there. We prayed Vespers together.
The Basilica of St. Paul outside the walls has, of course, become something of a symbol of the ecumenical movement. How much is ecumenism a part of this week's focus for your meeting?
Well, I think ecumenism is always a focus. I mean, to a certain extent, this conference is simply a conference for the members of the Society of Catholic Priests. But especially if you come to Rome, and then especially if you go to the Basilica of Paul, you have your eye on ecumenical matters. And for us, what's very special about coming to Rome is the fact that it is possible to drink deeply from the wells of Catholicism. And one of the things I think many of us have felt is not only we felt enriched simply by being in Rome, but also by studying Paul through the lens of Roman Catholicism and seeing particularly the sites where Pauline devotion is particularly important. Because of course within the Church of England and the Anglican tradition, Paul is read both in a Lutheran way and a Protestant way, but also in a Catholic way. And so we feel that we've been deeply enriched this week simply by being here.
How important do you think is it, the study of our forefathers in the faith, if you like, going back to the roots, going back to the Gospels, going back to St. Paul and the saints? How important is this, do you think, for the ecumenical movement today?
Well, I'm a biblical scholar, so you would expect me to say hugely important. And of course, I think it is enormously important. And in fact, one of the things I think is one of the greatest gifts of ecumenism is our ability to sit together and study the scriptures and the early fathers, but particularly the scriptures, because it is our reading of the scriptures together that gives us that common life in Christ, which is so important for our ecumenical work.
You yourself, of course, are a member of ARCHIC 3, aren't you?
I am indeed, yes.
You were at the recent meeting in Hong Kong to take forward these discussions on authority, how decisions are made, and the ethical questions that both communions are facing. Can you give us a sense of that meeting, what went on, and what you think perhaps were the results, the fruits of that meeting?
Well, I think we all found this second meeting of ARCHIC 3. The first meeting was one in which we were simply getting to know each other and to feel where we were going and to understand who each other were. I came away feeling from the second meeting enormously excited, because it felt as though we had begun to work out not only where we were going, but how we were going to do it. And it seems to me that one of the things that ARCHIC 3 may be working its way towards is an understanding of a slightly different ecumenical method, which is about the deep appreciation of each other's traditions.
What does that mean in practical terms?
Well, I think one of the things that becomes increasingly clear as we are engaged in these kind of conversations is that both from the Roman Catholic side, but also from the Anglican side, we have very superficial knowledge of the other's tradition. Obviously, some people have greater knowledge, other people have lesser knowledge, but regularly throughout the meeting, we were surprised and said, do you really think that, or have you really done that? And one of the really striking things, I think, about this meeting was a realisation that actually simply sitting and listening to what it was like to be a Roman Catholic and what it's like to be an Anglican, what it feels like, how we think about things, where we start, what processes we put in place, all of those things can really help us in our ecumenical method.
You're a group of 20 people, 10 on each side,
yes,
roughly speaking. How on earth can this little group of 20 people, if you like, bring their message to the wider church communities that you represent?
I think it's always the problem of international ecumenical conversations. And if you trace your way, even just looking at the previous ARCHIC reports, one of the striking things is the small group go on an enormous journey together and are themselves transformed. But one of the greatest challenges, I think, is being able to bring that process and that journey outwards into the greater church life. And it is one of those issues that we're very concerned with in ARCHIC 3 about how we might be able to draw other people into our conversations. And so I think what we are going to be trying to do is, rather than just produce one definitive report at the end, actually to send out papers and reflections so that people can see how where we are on our journey. And our great hope is that local ARCs, Anglican Roman Catholic dialogues in various places around the world, will pick those up and have their own conversations around them and then send their conversations back to us. So it's a method in which we sit in the hub and send out initial ideas, but then very much listen to the responses that come back and hopefully to weave that into the work that we're doing.
Because you're discussing some of the most difficult, some of the most controversial issues in both churches today, aren't you? Issues around pro-life, around sexuality. How are you tackling these, and what kind of message can you send to people, many of whom say it's hard to see how there will ever be any progress on this?
I think one of the things that became clear during this meeting, the meeting that we've just had, is that actually what we need to do in our ecumenical conversations is not so much focus on the decisions that have been made, because of course that's where we begin to diverge almost immediately, but to reflect on how the decisions are made in the first place. So one of the things that we became quite clear about is that while we'll be looking at these enormously controversial subjects, we're looking at the decision-making process rather than the end product. Although, of course, the end product comes into it, but the most important thing is the decision-making process. And actually to realise that Anglicans can learn a huge amount from the way in which Roman Catholics make decisions and vice versa, and that there is much to learn from each one of our traditions about how we get to the decisions that we get to.
It could be said that those decision-making processes are also perhaps the most controversial issues in the church today. Within the Anglican world, the search for some kind of central unity. Within the Catholic Church, the difficulty of relations between the Pope, the Curia, and local bishops' conferences. Again, you're touching on the heart of both churches' structure, aren't you?
Absolutely we are. I think that one of the things that is enormously helpful is simply to observe it and to reflect on it. And we almost certainly will not come to an absolute resolution in which we all suddenly fall into each other's arms and say, yes, of course, we're all right. But actually what's important is not, again, the end product, but the journey to along the way. And it seems to me that actually what Archic 3 has embarked on is a very important and very significant journey. And despite the fact that it's controversial, and despite the fact we are unlikely to agree on certain areas, the journey is nevertheless worth making, I think, because if we can all join in that journey, we will be transformed as we journey along the way together.
What gives you most hope, most inspiration on this journey?
I think it is the faith and the devotion of the people that I see journeying with me. For me, one of the most special times in Archic is the way in which we worship together. It is the daily worship in which, sitting alongside each other, I can observe, reflect upon, and be inspired by the deep faith of my brothers and sisters who are both Roman Catholic and Anglican. And it's in that that we have the inspiration, I think, for continuing.
And yet cannot share at the same table for communion, for the Eucharist.
Indeed so. And again, that brings you to an enormously painful place where you recognise both the inspiration of our traditions, but the great divide. And it seems to me that one of our callings as Christians, St. Paul in 2 Corinthians 4 regularly talks about carrying the death and the life of Christ around within the body. And it seems to me that Archic 3, what it is that we're doing is we are illustrating that actually in the way in which we're carrying about our conversations. We are fully aware of the pain and the heartache of the divisions between our churches, and yet at the same time we remain inspired and excited about the life that we see springing forth both in the Roman Catholic Church and in the Anglican churches. And it therefore is we're living out Paul's great vision of the carrying of the death and the life together, so that life springs forth in the recognition of where death and heartache lies.
My thanks there to Canon Paula Gooder, a member of Archic 3, the Anglican Roman Catholic International Commission, who was accompanying the Society of Catholic Priests on pilgrimage here to Rome.
If you're listening to this broadcast on medium or shortwave in Europe or America, then this announcement is for you. As of July 1st, our programs will no longer be broadcast in these areas and on these frequencies, but they will still be available via satellite, on the internet, on demand and in podcast, and on local radio stations that rebroadcast them. For details, visit our website at vaticanradio.va.
And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Do join us again at this same time tomorrow if you can. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.